Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Matt Jensen, The Last Mountain Man. Number 6, Dakota Ambush, by William W. Johnstone with J.A. Johnstone. Narrated by Terrence Aselford, with performances by Thomas Penny, Tim Getman, Thomas Keegan, Christopher Sheeran, Richard Rowan, Michael John Casey, Joe Brack, Mort Shelby, James Konacek, Yasmin Toison, Christopher Graybill, Dylan Lynch, Stephen Carpenter, Eva Wilhelm, Kimberly Gilbert, Eric Messner, David Coyne, Johann Detweiler, Tim Carlin, Colleen Delaney, Gregory Gorton, Danny Gavigan, Ren Casey, Elizabeth Jernigan, Drew Copas, Gary Tells, Ken Jackson, Tim Pabon, Jeff Allen, Michael Glenn, Bobby Aselford, James Lewis, Bradley Smith, Nathaniel Perry, and Nanette Savard. When Matt Jensen rode into Swan, Wyoming, few who knew him would have recognized him. He had a heavy beard, his hair was uncommonly long, and he looked every bit the part of a man who had not been under a roof for 2 months. 8 weeks earlier, he had said goodbye to Smoke Jensen back at Fort Collins, Colorado, arranging to meet him here in Swan on this date. Not since then had Matt seen civilization, having spent the entire 2 months in the mountains prospecting for gold. The success of Matt's 2 months of isolation was now manifested by a canvas bag he had hanging from the saddle horn. The bag was full of color-showing ore. Prospecting wasn't new to Matt. He had learned the trade under the tutelage of his mentor, Smoke Jensen, so he knew the color of the ore was genuine. But exactly how successful he had been would depend upon the assayer's report. Swan was a fly-blown little settlement, not served by any railroad, though there was stagecoach service to Rawlings, where one could connect with the Union Pacific. The town had a single street that was lined on both sides by unpainted, ripsawed, false-fronted buildings. It could have been any of several hundred towns in a dozen western states. As Matt rode down the street, a couple of scantily dressed, soiled doves stood on a balcony and called down to him.
Hey, cowboy! You're new to town, ain't ya?
You gotta be new, 'cause I don't know ya. And I reckon I know just about every man in town, if you get my drift.
Matt smiled, nodded, and touched the brim of his hat by way of returning their greeting.
Come on up and keep us company. We give you a good welcome.
Ladies, until I get a bath, I'm not even fit company for my horse.
Shoo, honey! You got that right. I can smell you from up here.
Matt rode on down the street until he reached a small building at the far end. A sign in front of the building read, J.C. Montgomery, Assayer. Matt swung down from his saddle and tied his horse off at the hitching rail. Hefting the canvas bag over one shoulder, he stepped inside, where he was greeted by a small, thin man.
Can I help you?
Are you the assayer?
I am.
Matt laid the canvas bag on the counter, then took out a handful of rocks and laid them alongside the bag.
Need you to take a look at this.
You want me to tell you if it's gold or pyrite, right?
No, mister, I know it's gold. All I want you to do is tell me how much money all this is worth.
The assayer picked up a couple of rocks and looked at them casually before putting them back down. Then, taking a second look at one of them, he picked it up again. This time, he examined it through a magnifying glass.
What do you think?
You're right. It is gold.
You have any idea as to the value?
Do all the rocks have this much color?
I wouldn't have bothered carrying them if it didn't.
Well, then, I'd say you have $200 or $300 here. In fact, I'll give you $300 for the entire bag right now.
Matt put the rocks back in the bag.
Would you now?
In cash.
You always cheat your customers like that?
What are you talking about?
What I have here is worth $2,000 if it's worth a cent. Thank you, Mr. Montgomery, but I believe I'll take my business somewhere else.
I'm the only assayer in town.
Perhaps. But Swan isn't the only town.
Just up the street from the assayer's office, Matt saw a sign that read, Haircuts, Shaves, Baths.
Tell you what, Spirit, you've had to put up with my stink long enough. I think I'll go get myself cleaned up before I go looking for smoke.
15 minutes later, he was sitting in a tub of warm water, scrubbing himself with a big piece of lye soap.
Don't know if there's enough lye soap in all of Wyoming to get that carcass clean.
Smoke!
No, need to stand. You think I want to see that?
How'd you know I was in here?
We did say we were going to meet in Swan today, didn't we?
Yeah.
I saw Spirit tied up out front. Did you think I wouldn't recognize him? He used to be my horse, remember?
I remember.
How did you do?
See that bag there? It's full of ore. At least $2,000 worth, I'd guess.
That is good.
Tell you what, I'll be finished here in a bit. What do you say we go get us a beer? I haven't had a beer in 2 months.
Sounds good to me. I'll go get us a table, and I'll even let you buy it, seeing as you had such a good outing.
A few minutes after Smoke left, Matt was out of the tub, had his shirt and trousers on, and had just strapped on his gun belt when three men burst unexpectedly into the room. All three had pistols in their hands.
We'll take that bag of ore, mister.
Who are you?
Where the folks are going to give that bag of ore to?
Matt drew his pistol lightning quick.
Not anymore, you're not.
Matt was still examining the bodies when four more men came bursting into the room. This time, three of them were carrying sawed-off shotguns. They were also wearing badges. The fourth man with them was the assayer.
There he is, Sheriff. He's the one who stole the bag of ore.
What? What are you talking about? I didn't steal any ore from you.
He come into the office a little while ago. He had a bag of worthless rocks, using it as a way to get my attention. While I was looking at his rocks, he stole a bag of genuine ore. I didn't have no choice but to send my brother and two cousins to get the ore back. Didn't know it would come to this, though.
Montgomery looked down at the three dead bodies, then shook his head sadly.
If I'd known they was gonna be murdered like this, I never would have sent them over here. A bag plumb full of gold nuggets isn't worth getting three good men killed.
Come along, mister. You're about to learn that folks don't come into my town and steal and murder and get away with it.
Sheriff, this man is lying. I brought some ore in for him to assay. He tried to cheat me out of it, so I told him I'd go somewhere else. You think I'd stop to take a bath if I stole anything in this town?
I don't know what you'd do, mister. But the thing is, I know Montgomery, and I don't know you. So I reckon we'll let the judge sort it all out.
Matt looked at the three shotguns that were leveled at him. He was holding a pistol, and he had a notion, but declined. Matt turned the pistol around and handed it, handle first, to the sheriff.
You're making a mistake, Sheriff.
You let me worry about that.
Montgomery reached for the sack of gold ore.
Leave it, Montgomery.
Why should I leave it, Sheriff? This is the selfsame sack of ore he stole.
Leave it. We'll let the judge decide whether or not that gold ore is yours.
Montgomery glared at the sheriff, then looked over at Matt.
I'll be standing in the crowd watching you hang.
Let's go, mister. I got a nice jail cell for you until the judge gets here.
Matt had been in jail for 3 days, awaiting the arrival of the circuit judge so he could be tried. Smoke was just outside his cell, visiting with him.
I shouldn't have left you.
Why not? If you'd stayed, you'd be in jail with me right now. What good would that do?
I guess you have a point. If you can't convince the judge that you're innocent, I'll take matters into my own hands. I'll get you out of here, no matter what I have to do.
Matt looked up to see the sheriff coming into the jailhouse, leading Montgomery. Montgomery was in shackles.
What's going on?
You're free to go. Mr. Montgomery here will be taking your place.
Sheriff, I have to hand it to you for doing your job. You've had a good 3 days of investigating.
Well, it wasn't me. It was John Bryce.
Who?
John Bryce. Mr. Bryce is a newspaper writer for the Swan Journal, and he's been doing something he calls, investigative journalism. Here, read this.
Matt took the newspaper.
An innocent man in jail. J.A. Montgomery is a crook and should be called to account. We are under obligation to report to the public in general and to Sheriff Daniels in particular, the criminal activities of J.A. Montgomery, who has set himself up in Swan as an assayer. Montgomery is no such thing. Although he has hanging on the wall of his office a degree from Colorado School of Mines, this newspaper is in receipt of a letter from that institution claiming that no such person as J.A. Montgomery graduated nor was ever a student there. Further investigation has disclosed that Montgomery is wanted by the sheriff of Madison County, Montana, where, also fraudulently passing himself off as an assayer, he murdered and robbed a prospector. The circumstances of that event are so similar to the recent event between J.A. Montgomery, his brother Clyde, and two cousins Drake and Birch, and a recent visitor to our town, Matt Jensen, that this newspaper believes Mr. Jensen, who is currently incarcerated, is innocent. Should Matt Jensen be any longer detained, it would be a gross miscarriage of justice. Subjecting the county to a trial to establish his innocence would be a waste of time and taxpayers' money. The writer of this piece, John Bryce, is willing to stake his reputation upon the accuracy of this report and urges Sheriff Daniels to act quickly to correct this error.
After the paper came out, I sent a telegram to the sheriff of Madison County, Montana, and he answered that Montgomery was wanted for murder, just like the newspaper article said. Then I went over to talk to Montgomery and found that he was trying to leave town.
So I'm free to go?
Yes, sir. You're free as a bird.
Is this fella John Bryce in town?
Yes, sir. He's over to the newspaper office right now.
I think I'll go look him up right now. You own this paper?
Oh, heavens no. Takes a lot of money to own and operate your own newspaper. I just work here for Mr. Peabody as one of his journalists. Someday I expect to own my own paper, though.
Matt, who had had the ore returned to him, reached down into his canvas bag and pulled out four good-sized rocks.
Here, cash these in and you may have your paper sooner than you realize. If there's ever anything I can do for you, just let me know.
Bless you, Mr. Jensen. I'll never forget you for this.
Fullerton, Dakota Territory, 12 years later. A brick had been thrown through the front window, and great jagged spears of the glass reached out from all corners of the frame. 2 months earlier, John Bryce had paid a professional painter to come over from Bismarck to paint on the glass. Fullerton Defender, John Bryce, publisher, Millie Bryce, office manager. The letters were broad and black, outlined in white and gold. That sign, once a source of pride, was now no more than a few remaining letters on the remaining shards of glass. At the moment, John was standing just inside the office of the Fullerton Defender, surveying the damage. The perpetrators had done more than just break his front window. They had also trashed the office. His arm around his wife, he held her close to him as she sobbed quietly. Type had been scattered around the room. Newsprint had been ripped and spread around. The Washington Hand Press, which John used to put out his weekly paper, was lying on its side. They had to come to the newspaper office directly from their breakfast table, having been told of the break-in by City Marshal Tipton. More than a dozen citizens of the town had already been drawn to the scene of the crime by the time John and Millie arrived, and they were standing in a little cluster out on the boardwalk, just in front of the building. The perpetrators had left a note.
Don't be written no more bad articles about Lord Denby, or we will come back, spelled K-U-M, and do more D-A-M-I-G-E to you next time.
Who would do such a thing?
It's fairly apparent, isn't it? Denby did it.
We don't know that.
The note doesn't suggest that to you, Marshal.
Just the opposite. Denby's an educated man. Now, I'm not as smart as you are, but even I know how to spell the words come and damage.
I don't mean Denby did it himself. I mean he had it done.
Or maybe there are just some people in town who got upset with you because you've been coming down pretty hard on Denby and your stories. And Denby's done a lot of good for this town.
Really? What good has he done?
Let's just say that he does a lot of business with the town.
Yes. By allowing only the businesses he wants to stay and squeezing out the others. He's killing this town, Marshal Tipton. And the people in town know it. Only they're too frightened to do anything about it.
So you planned a man a one-person campaign, do you, Bryce?
If I am the only one willing to do anything about it, then yes. I will mount a one-person campaign.
Look what it got you.
It set me back a bit, I'll admit. But it won't stop me. It'll take me a day to clean up. I'll have the paper out this Thursday, just as I do every Thursday.
A small boy of 12 stepped away from the crowd outside and closer to the broken window.
I'll help you pick up all the type, Mr. Bryce.
Thank you, Kenny.
I can go get Jimmy to help, too, if you want me to.
That would be nice.
John looked past the boy to the group of people who were still standing just outside the office and saw Ernie Westphaling. Ernie, who had been a colonel during the Civil War, was now a local businessman who owned a gun store.
Ernie, would you help me set the printing press back up?
Sure thing.
A couple of the other men also volunteered to help. Within a few minutes, the printing press had been righted and was once again in its proper place. John surveyed it for a moment or two, then smiled.
Not a scratch. Takes more than a few of Denby's hooligans to put old George out of business.
George? I thought your name was John.
It is. George is the name of my printing press.
You've named your press?
Sure. It's not only part of this newspaper, it's the heart of the newspaper.
What are you going to do about your window?
I'll have to order a new glass from Bismarck, Ernie. In the meantime, I guess I'll just board that side up.
What are you going to do about this, Marshal?
I'll look into it, see if I can find out who did it. But if I don't come up with any witnesses, I don't know what I can do.
There has to be a witness somewhere. It had to make a lot of noise when they broke out the window.
You live no more than a couple blocks from here, Mrs. Bryce. Did you hear anything?
No.
And the newspaper belongs to you and your husband, so you would be even more attentive, I would think. You heard nothing, but you expect others in the town did? No, ma'am. I don't expect I'm going to find anything.
That's because you aren't looking in the right place. You and I both know who's behind this.
Tipton glared at John, but he said nothing.
Is the son of a bitch still following?
Cyrus Hayes and Emmett Cruz had stopped for a moment in order for Hayes to relieve himself. And Cruz crawled up onto a rock to look back along the trail.
Yeah, he's there.
What the hell? Are we leaving breadcrumbs or something? Who the hell is that, and how the hell's he staying on our trail?
I don't know who he is, but he's good.
Yeah, well, let's go. The more distance we can put between us and him, the better I'll feel.
Earlier that morning, Hayes and Cruz had robbed the Rocky Mountain Bank and Trust in Pueblo, Colorado, and during the robbery had shot down in cold blood a teller and two customers. The two customers, a man and his pregnant wife, had been friends of Matt Jensen. Because of that, even before the state got around to offering a reward for the two bank robbers and murderers, Matt had gone after them. Knowing they would be pursued, the two outlaws took great pains to cover their true trail while leaving false trails for anyone who would follow. Then, reaching a stream, they started riding right down the middle of it, confident that they were erasing any sign that could possibly be followed. For most trackers, that might work, but not for Matt. He had learned his tracking expertise from Smoke Jensen, who had learned his own skills from an old mountain man named Preacher. And Preacher was, arguably, the best tracker who had ever lived. Because that know-how had been passed down, Matt was almost equally as accomplished as Smoke or Preacher. He could even follow a trail through the water by paying attention to such things as rocks dislodged against the flow of water, or silt, which, when disturbed by horses' hooves, would leave a little pattern in the water for several minutes afterward. A .44-40 bullet shot through the air no more than an inch from Matt's head. Matt leaped down from his horse and ran through the stream.
Damn! A rifle and a pistol!
Reaching the bank on the opposite side of the stream, Matt dived to the ground. He worked his way toward a nearby outcropping of rocks. There he sat with his back against the biggest of the rocks.
Who are you?
My name is Jensen.
Jensen? Matt Jensen? Son of a bitch!
Which one are you? You Hayes or Cruz?
What? I'm Hayes. How did you know our names?
Half the town saw you two boys riding away from the bank, and half the ones who saw you knew who you were.
What are you after us for, Jensen? I heard of you, but I ain't never heard that you was someone who would chase a fella down for the reward. Is that why you're chasing us?
I'm not after the reward.
Then if you ain't after the reward, what the hell are you coming after us for?
Seems the right thing to do.
Well, mister, you made a big mistake. Because all you're going to do now is get yourself killed. You still there?
I'm still here.
I tell you what, mister. Me and my partner here just talked it over. And we got us an idea. We got us near about $5,000 that we've taken from the bank. $1,000 of it's yarn if and you'll just go away.
No deal.
All right. How about $2,000? We'll give you $2,000 and all you got to do is just let us ride away.
You expect me to believe you two are willing to give me nearly half of what you took from the bank?
Well, why not? It's no big deal. We can always rob another bank. $2,000. You don't come across money like that very often now, do you?
Not very often.
So what do you think? You gonna take us up on our offer?
Let me think about it.
Yeah, you do that.
Matt picked up a stick about 2 feet long, put his hat on top of the stick, then raised it slightly above the rock. The hat flew off the end of the stick.
Ho ho ho! Oh, you got him, Cruz!
Whoa! Guess you two boys weren't really serious about giving me all that money, were you?
Son of a bitch, I missed! Mister, you know what I said about giving you that money? Well, you can forget about it. We ain't giving you nothing! Except maybe a bullet right between your eyes!
The bullet spun into the valley. After that shot, there was silence, which stretched into several long minutes.
Ace? Cruz? Still up there?
This time the bullet hit just to the right of Matt.
He's improved his position.
This time Matt saw the puff of smoke from the rifle, so he aimed at the spot and waited. Seconds later, he was rewarded by seeing Cruz's face raise up. Matt saw Cruz fall forward, sliding belly down until his face wound up in the stream. Matt watched for a moment longer to make certain Cruz was dead. Looking around, Matt saw that Hayes had used the opportunity to get mounted and was now galloping toward him. Hayes had his pistol in his hand. Matt fired back. He saw a puff of dust rising from Hayes' vest, followed by a tiny spray of dust and blood. Hayes pitched backward out of his saddle, but one foot hung in the stirrup, and the horse continued to run, raising a plume of water as the outlaw was dragged through the stream. When the horse reached the other side of the stream and started up the bank, Hayes' foot disconnected from the stirrup. Hayes lay motionless, half in the water and half out, not more than 10 feet from where the body of his partner lay. Matt ran over to them, his gun still drawn, but the gun wasn't necessary. Hayes and Cruz were not the first outlaws Matt had ever tracked down. He was neither a lawman nor someone who hunted other men for any reward the government paid for them. But he was always on the side of law and order. And sometimes, like this time, going after an outlaw just seemed to be the right thing to do. Matt took the bag of bank money from Hayes' saddle and started back to Pueblo. But just after noon, his horse stepped into an unseen prairie dog hole. The horse broke a leg, and Matt had to shoot him. It was a hard thing to do. Spirit was only the second horse he had ever owned. Indeed, this horse had carried with him the spirit of his first horse, who was also named, not coincidentally, Spirit. There was nothing Matt could do now but take Shank's mare. So, throwing his saddle, saddlebags, and the money bag over his shoulder, he began walking. He walked for 2 hours. Eventually, he climbed up a berm to stand on the ballast between two railroad tracks some 30 miles south of Pueblo. Before him, the clear tracks of the Denver and New Orleans lay like twin ribbons across the landscape, stretching north to south from horizon to horizon. For that moment, they were as cold and empty as the barren sand, rocks, and mountains that surrounded him. But Matt knew that a train would be passing through there sometime before sundown. All that was left for him to do was catch the train. So, using his saddle as a pillow, he lay down beside the tracks to wait. Soon he got up from his impromptu bed and looked south toward the approaching train. When it was close enough for him to be seen, Matt stepped up onto the track and began waving. After a few waves, he heard the train begin braking, so he knew that the engineer had spotted him and was going to stop. The engineer's face appeared in the window.
What do you want, mister? Why'd you stop us?
My horse stepped in a prairie dog hole and I had to put him down. Need a ride.
The engineer stroked his chin for a moment, studying Matt as if trying to decide whether or not he should pick him up.
What's going on here? Why did we stop?
Another man approached the engine quickly and importantly from somewhere toward the back of the train. He was wearing the uniform of a conductor.
This fella needs a ride. His horse went down on him.
I'm not in the habit of giving charity rides to indigents.
I can pay. Need to get to Pueblo.
You can pay, can you? Well, let me ask you this. Does this place look like a depot to you? Do you think you can just flag down a train and board it anywhere you wish?
I don't know about you, Mr. Gordon, but I wouldn't feel right just leaving him out here. I mean, him losing his horse and all kind of makes it like an emergency, don't it?
The conductor stroked his chin and spent a long moment studying Matt.
All right, Cephas. Have it your way. Mister, I don't like unscheduled stops like this, but I don't want it said that I left you stranded out here. It is going to cost you $2 to go to Pueblo.
Here you are. Thanks.
Sorry about your horse, mister.
Yeah, he was a good horse.
In an elaborate gesture, the conductor pulled a watch from his vest pocket and popped open the cover and examined the face. The silver watch was attached to a gold chain, the chain making a shallow U across his chest.
Cephas, we are due in Pueblo exactly 1 hour and 27 minutes from right now. I don't plan to be late. That means I expect you to make up the time we've lost by this stop.
Yes, sir, Mr. Gordon, don't worry. If Doodle keeps the steam up, we'll be there on time.
Now, don't you be worrying none about the steam. You'll have all the steam you need.
Come along. You can ride in any car. There are seats in all three of them, and they're all-day coaches.
Rather ride an express car, if you don't mind.
No, I'm sorry. I can't let you in there.
Maybe you haven't heard, but the bank in Pueblo was robbed this morning.
Yes, I heard. What does that have to do with anything?
Matt held up the canvas bag he had taken from Cyrus Hayes' body.
This is the money that was taken from the bank.
What? What the hell, mister? Are you telling me that you are the one who held up the bank?
No, I'm the one who's taking the money back to the bank. And I'd just as soon not be riding in one of the passenger cars while I'm carrying it.
Oh.
At that moment, the door to the express car slid open, and the express messenger looked down at them.
He can ride in here with me, Mr. Gordon. He'll be all right.
I'll let him in there, but remember, it was your idea, not mine.
I'll remember. Hi, Matt.
Matt smiled up at a friend with whom he'd played cards many times.
Hey, Jerry.
When Slater, Dillon, and Wilson tied their horses off in front of the New York Saloon in Fullerton, they saw a small, pasty-faced man sitting on a bench on the front porch.
Howdy, Butcher.
The little man nodded but made no response.
You want us to bring you out a beer?
I don't drink.
All right, just thought I'd ask.
With an arrogance brought on by the fact that they rode for Nigel Denby, the largest rancher in Dickey County, the three men swaggered up to the bar and pushed aside some of the customers who were already there.
Find another place to be, Pilgrim. Me and my pards need this space.
Not wanting any trouble, the man took his beer and retreated to the far end of the bar.
Three whiskeys.
Coming up.
You really reckon Butram don't drink?
I don't think it's as much that he don't drink as it is that he can't drink.
What do you mean he can't?
Well, look at him. You ever see a fully grown man that was that little? Well, I bet one beer would just about make him drunker than a skunk.
Maybe that's why Lord Denby hired him. He has to sit out there on that porch every day, checking to make sure folks have paid their toll. Anybody else might be drinking all day, but seeing as Butram don't drink, well, that ain't no problem.
That's not the only reason he was hired. Don't you know who that is?
Yeah, I know who he is. His name is Butram.
Yeah, Butram. Ollie Butram. He may be little, but don't let that fool you. They say he's killed more than 20 men.
Yeah, folks may say that, but has he really?
I don't know. You want to try him?
No, no. If that's what folks say, then as far as I'm concerned, it's all true, every word of it.
Bartender, how about another 3 shots? Hey, I hear tell the newspaper fella had himself a little trouble the other night. I hear tell he broke out his window, messed up his place pretty good. Did you hear that?
I heard it.
Serves him right. Anyone who would write all those lies about Lord Denby deserves to have his place all torn up. I bet he won't be writing any more lies, seeing as how he can't get his paper out anymore.
What makes you think he won't get his paper out anymore? I understand it'll come out this Thursday, same as always.
Well, how can it, if his press is broke?
Well, it wasn't broken. It was pushed over, but it wasn't broken. I told you we should have took an axe.
Shut up, Wilson, you fool.
Oh. Yeah, I was just saying, we need to take an axe back out of the ramp so we can get to work on some of them stumps.
Slater glared at him for a moment, then turned his back to the bar and studied the saloon. Seeing one of the bar girls occupied with a customer, he walked over to that table.
Step aside, friend. I'm taking your woman.
Slater reached out to take the girl by the arm.
Me and her's gonna go up to her room for a bit. Oh, don't worry, though. I'll be finished with her soon. It's been a while since I had me a woman, so it ain't gonna take me very long to get the job done, if you get what I mean.
What makes you think that I'll go upstairs with you?
'Cause you're a whore, and that's what whores do.
Other whores, maybe, but not this whore. I do what I want to do, and right now, I'm enjoying a conversation with my gentleman friend.
Yeah? Well, now you're gonna enjoy that conversation with me.
I don't think so.
Oh, I think you'll talk to me. 'Cause if you don't, I'm gonna pistol whip this here gentleman you was talking to.
The gentleman tensed, but the woman put her hand on his shoulder.
Don't worry. Before I let him hurt you, I'll go with him.
Slater reholstered his pistol.
Yeah, I thought you might.
Kay! You all right?
Yes, Paul, I'm fine. This won't be the first time I've ever had to deal with Mr. Slater.
What makes you dislike me so much?
I don't like you because you have a very tiny pecker.
The others in the room laughed outrageously, and Slater's face turned beet red. He vowed not to ask any more questions that might trip him up. But when the 3 men galloped out of town an hour later, they yelled and fired their pistols into the air. Townsfolk moved quickly to get out of the way. In the office of the Fullerton Defender, John Bryce stood in the doorway and watched.
What's all the noise?
It's some of Denby's riders razzing the town. Slater, Dillon, and Wilson.
It will be them. They're the worst of the lot.
No, the little gargoyle that Denby keeps posted on the front porch of the saloon. Buttram, he's the worst of the lot.
You would think Denby would have more control over his men.
He does have control over them. You think Denby didn't know his men were going to trash our office? He not only knew it, he ordered it done.
Marshal Tipton says it could have been someone from town. Either someone upset or someone doing it as a prank.
What sort of prank would tearing up somebody's place of business be? No. Whoever it was did exactly what Denby wanted them to do. He wants not only us, but the whole town to be intimidated. And he's about succeeded with the town. That's why he lets ruffians like Slater, Dillon, and Wilson act without restraint.
John walked back to the Washington hand press and peeled off the first page of the newspaper. He took it over to the light of the front window to read the copy.
Listen. The Northern Express Stage Company. Intelligence received from the above-mentioned company suggests that they would offer the best route from Fullerton south to Ellendale. The route bringing within easy reach the railroad, which, by connections, would provide our citizens with easy travel to all the great metropolises of America. This company has plans to equip their line with 12 of the best and most comfortable Concord coaches with 160 horses, and would establish stations and supply ranches along the route at distances from 12 and not to exceed 15 miles apart. Though the Indians are believed to offer little or no trouble, the Northern Express Stage and Transportation Company has of late expressed some concern as to whether they will be able to put their plans into effect at all. Mr. R.A. Weatherly, operations officer for the company, released the following statement.
It has come to the attention of this company that one individual has gained control of the Ellendale Highway and is imposing a toll upon all who make use of the road. We cannot and will not pay tolls for the passages of our coaches, for to do so would render the profit so marginal as to be non-productive.
Though Mr. Weatherly mentioned no names, this newspaper feels an obligation to its readers to publish herein the name of the individual whose actions may cost our town this important transportation service. His name is Nigel Denby, and he has made the spurious claim that because the road passes through his property, it is subject to a toll to be collected by him. An appeal to Sheriff Hightower in Ellendale has availed us of no relief from this condition, and many of our citizens have already faced personal hardship because of the toll Denby has established on the Ellendale Road. I am sending by post a copy of this newspaper to Governor Ordway in Bismarck, with the hope that he will see his way to right this wrong that is being perpetrated against us. What do you think, Millie?
Millie was not only John's wife, she was also a valued employee, for she could set type, operate the press, and even write a column that was aimed specifically at the ladies of Fullerton. She had come to work for John when he started the newspaper some 2 years earlier, and the work relationship grew to something more. That was when John Bryce, who had thought that he would never be married, took her as his bride.
I read it when I set the type. I still don't know what I think.
What do you mean you don't know? You think it isn't a good story?
John, it's a wonderful story, and why shouldn't it be? You are, after all, a wonderful writer. But I don't want to see our place all messed up again. Or worse.
What do you mean, worse?
You know what I mean, John.
John walked over to Millie and put his arm around her, then pulled her to him.
Denby is an evil man, Millie. But he isn't dumb. And killing a public figure like me would be a dumb thing to do.
I hope you're right.
What I hope is that the effect of this article will be to galvanize the governor, the sheriff, the mayor, and the citizens of this town into action against the evil Mr. Denby.
And I fear it will have just the opposite result. Already some of the people are concerned over what happened here the other night.
Concern? Nonsense. Why should they be concerned?
They're afraid it might happen to them.
That's nonsense.
John, sometimes I feel as if you are trapped in a soap bubble. It is a wonderful soap bubble, filled with all the noble ideas of honor, truth, and justice. But you see nothing beyond that bubble. The people of town are afraid that Denby will react to your stories by stopping all business dealings with Fullerton. And whether you like him or not, you must admit that he does a great deal of business with the people of the town. They're afraid they will lose that business.
Ah, they're being foolish. Don't they understand that without his interference, they would do even more business?
Nevertheless, the whole town is afraid. And I fear some may, out of their fear, stop doing business with us. I know you feel strongly about this, but we do have our own well-being to consider.
Millie, you know yourself that if this town dies, we will as well. A newspaper can survive only as long as the public it serves survives. I am looking out for our own well-being.
I suppose you're right. But I beg of you, John, to please exercise some caution.
At that moment, Kenny Perkins came through the open door into the office. Kenny Perkins was the 12-year-old who had come to help pick up the scattered type. It was no accident he was there because Kenny worked for John. He was the son of Ma Perkins, a widow who owned a boarding house as well as a couple of other businesses. Kenny's father, Emil, had been killed 3 years earlier in a mining accident. Like his mother, Kenny had a nose for business, and he had convinced John that he needed a paperboy to deliver the Fullerton Defender. As it turned out, Kenny proved to be a very good paperboy, so the arrangement had a mutual benefit.
Did you get the Thursday paper out, Mr. Bryce?
Indeed I did, Kenny.
I knew you would. Are the papers ready to go yet?
That they are, Kenny, that they are. Go, quickly now. And wearing the shoes of Hermes, attend to your appointed rounds.
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm not wearing this fellow Hermes' shoes. Heck, warm as it is today, I'm not wearing any shoes at all, see?
Kenny held up one of his feet and wiggled his toes.
The young man speaks the truth, Millie. His feet are as bare as the feet of a newborn babe.
You're funny, Mr. Bryce.
Kenny took the papers, then started up Monroe Avenue, which was the main street of town, with his delivery.
Now there goes a good boy.
Yes, he is, and you shouldn't tease him so.
Oh, he enjoys it. Besides, without a father, he needs a man to joke with him now and then.
I agree. But you can't say his mother isn't doing a good job with him. I've known Lucy for a long time. I just hope.
You hope what?
I hope the people who vandalized our newspaper office won't ever take it out on Kenny.
I'm sure they won't.
John took a sheet of stationery from his desk.
What are you doing?
I'm gonna write a letter.
To the governor?
No. I wrote to the governor once, and it didn't do any good. I'm writing this letter to Matt Jensen. But I'm going to send it to Smoke Jensen, because he's the only one I know how to reach. I'll ask him to forward the letter. I did a favor for Mr. Jensen once, and he said if there was ever anything he could do for me, to let him know. Well, there is something he can do for me now, and I'm about to let him know.
At that moment, 5 miles out of town, Ian McCann, his son Leo, McCann's two hands, Curly Dobbins and Slim Toomey, were moving 30 head of cattle along the Fullerton and Ellendale Road when they approached a barrier, a gate that was stretched across the road. Leo, who was in front, stopped.
What is it, boy? What'd you stop for?
Pa, the road is blocked.
What do you mean, blocked?
There's a gate across it.
Dobbins, Toomey, you two boys watch the animals.
Ian slapped his legs against the side of his horse and rode past the little group of cows until he reached the front and saw the gate. There were two men standing in front of the gate.
I'll be damned. What the hell is this anyway?
What does it look like? It's a toll gate.
Well, who are you?
Name's Bleeker. I'm in charge of the toll gate. You want to pass this way, you're going to have to pay a toll.
What? What are you talking about? This ain't no toll road. I've done come this way dozens of times. It's a public road.
It passes through Denby land. That makes it a toll road.
All right. How much you talking about?
$1 for each of you. And $1 for the critters that pass through. Except your horses. We won't charge you nothing for the horses.
Mister, are you out of your mind? I've got 30 cows and 4 men here. You're saying you want $34? I don't have that much money, and I wouldn't give it to you if I had it.
Oh, we can work something out.
Like what?
We'll take 3 of your cows.
I'm getting $26 a head for these animals from the Indian agent in Fullerton. That would be $60.
Well, you ain't exactly in Fullerton now, are you? You're on Denby land. Here your cows are worth $10 a head, and that means you're getting a bargain. You owe us $34, but I'm willing to take 30.
The hell you are. We'll just find some other way.
Too late.
What do you mean, too late?
You don't understand. You done come this far on Lord Denby's road. That means you already owe $34 whether you go through the gate or not.
You're crazy. I'm not going to pay you $34, and I'm not going to give you 3 cows.
Suddenly and unexpectedly, Bleeker drew his pistol.
What the hell, mister? We ain't neither one of us armed.
Bleeker pointed his pistol at the head of one of the cows. The cow dropped, and the others began milling about in fright. And if it had not been for Dobbins and Toomey, they might have scattered.
Now, if you'd been reasonable about it, you could have just given us 3 cows and gone on. Now, it's still going to cost you 3 cows, plus the one you just lost.
You're crazy!
Should we cut out the 3 cows, or do you want to choose?
I told you, I'm not going to give you 3 cows.
We shot a second cow, and once again, Dobbins and Toomey had to move quickly to control the remaining cows.
Stop it! For the love of God, man, what are you doing?
By your reckoning, you just lost $40, all because you wouldn't pay the $34 toll. Now, do I shoot another one, or do you give up 3 cows?
Yes, take them! Take them and be damned!
25 head. I thought we agreed upon 30 head.
I had 30 head when we left home.
Ian explained the run-in with Bleeker.
Yes. He works for Nigel Denby. That explains everything.
It explains nothing. Who the hell is this Denby anyway? And what gives him the right to collect tolls on a public road?
Right now, he is not only the biggest and wealthiest rancher in this part of Dakota, but he also has the biggest army.
Biggest army?
Yes. You would have to go all the way back to Fort Lincoln to find more men under arms than Lord Denby has on his ranch.
Lord Denby?
He's from England.
Yeah, well, I don't like it. I don't like it one bit. That son of a bitch cost me $100 today.
The bane of Elm Valley, in fact, the curse of all of Dickey County, was Lord Nigel Cordell Denby, 6th Marquess of Prestonshire. Denby was a tall, slender man who was always fastidiously dressed. He kept his hair, which was brown and graying at the temples, perfectly coiffed, and his pencil-thin mustache well-trimmed. The women of his social set back in England all agreed that he was handsome, though they also added that he was flawed in some way, rather like a stem of fine crystal with a small imperfection that at first glance couldn't be seen. The more one saw of Denby, though, the more the imperfection, not of physical form but of personal character, became evident. It was because of that imperfection that Denby had been asked by his family to leave England. Having been challenged to a duel by a jealous husband, Denby exercised his right to choose weapons, selecting a dueling pistol. Most duels fought among gentlemen used the rapier, the reason being that the duels were rarely, if ever, fatal. It was understood among members of the peerage that the application of a dueling scar would be enough to satisfy the honor of the aggrieved. Using a dueling pistol turned the duel from a gentleman's event to an act of murder by code. Because of that, few gentlemen were skilled in the use of the dueling pistol. Denby, however, practiced constantly with the pistol, and on the day of the duel killed his adversary, Lord Cedric Belford, with one well-placed shot. Denby was ostracized, not only for compromising Belford's wife, but also for taking unfair advantage of his prowess with a particular weapon when he was rightfully called to account. Wanting to avoid further embarrassment to the family, not only from the untidy effects of the duel, but from his other scandals as well, involving seduction, slander, betrayal, and personal greed, Denby was asked to leave England. The pain of his departure was eased, however, by the provision of several thousand acres of land on the Elm River in the Dakota Territory, USA, as well as a very generous yearly stipend. He had arrived in New York approximately 2 years earlier, accompanied by his manservant Tolliver, and carrying a grip with 35,000 pounds sterling. He was pleasantly surprised when he discovered that after the monetary exchange, he wound up with over a half million U.S. dollars. At first, Denby had been bitter and angry about the expulsion, but as he grew more acclimated to the situation, he came to the belief that his being sent to the United States was the best thing that could possibly happen to him. He soon realized that he could have much more power, influence, and wealth here than he ever could back in England. Giving his ranch the grandiose name of Prestonshire on Elm, he began to expand his holdings, buying out land adjacent to his own until his ranch surrounded the only road into the town of Fullerton. Then, realizing it would take a veritable army to run his fiefdom, he began hiring men, not only workers for his ranch, but men with whom he could form his own militia. For the moment, his rather large army was a drain on his resources, though he had so much money that he was in no danger of running out anytime soon. But despite the fact his private militia was costing him money, they paid their way by virtue of not only establishing, but extending his personal power. And he also knew that they would, when all his plans were put into operation, pay for themselves tenfold. It was Denby's dream, though it was a dream that so far he had shared with no one, to carve out a large feudal estate, encompassing all the farms and ranches in the entire valley into his sphere of control, assimilating the land as his own, and employing the small landowners as serfs, beholden only to him. At the moment he was examining a map of the valley with certain areas marked off, land that he owned, and land that he planned to acquire by whatever means possible.
Yes, Mr. Tolliver, what is it?
Henry Tolliver, a short and rather rotund man with a bald head and protruding lips, was Denby's personal valet, the son, grandson, and great-grandson of maids and valets who had served the Denby family for nearly 100 years. Tolliver had come to America with Denby.
My lord, Mr. Buttram wishes an audience.
Buttram was one of the latest men to join his militia. Denby hiring him after reading an article in the San Francisco newspaper describing him as, with a pistol, faster than thought, and in disposition, a man who can kill without compunction. As of now, Buttram was Denby's highest-paid employee.
Mr. Tolliver, why do I get the impression that you don't much like Mr. Buttram?
Perhaps it is because I do not like the man.
Why not?
I find his demeanor most unpleasant.
He kills people for a living, Mr. Tolliver. Someone who kills for a living can hardly be expected to have a very pleasant disposition, now can he?
No, sir.
Henry, I find our Mr. Buttram unpleasant as well. Not only Buttram, but every one of these cowboys, those who work for me and those who don't. You have to understand that they are not like you and me. Whereas we have generations of culture bred into us, these men are wild and uncouth. Little more than animals, really. But for now, I need them. I find myself in the unusual position of being dependent upon those who are far inferior. Now, if you would, please show Mr. Buttram into the study.
Yes, my lord.
Denby rolled up the map that he'd been examining so that Buttram couldn't see it. He didn't believe that Buttram was intelligent enough to discern the meaning of a map marked out with crosshatches, but he had no wish to discuss the matter with him. Ollie Buttram had buck teeth, eyes so pale a blue that they were almost colorless, pale skin and yellow hair. In a world of gentlemen, he would be marginalized, not only for his innate ugliness, but also because of his intelligence, which was minimal, and his demeanor, the antithesis of the proper etiquette and decorum that so occupied the world in which Denby was raised. But the Dakota Territory was not a world of gentlemen, and if a gentleman wanted to survive in this world, he needed an ally like Buttram, either as a friend, or better in this case, as a loyal and subservient employee.
Mr. Denby?
Denby said nothing, but held up his finger.
I mean, Lord Denby.
Yes, Mr. Buttram, what is it?
The paper come out again.
I expected that it would. Though he is a thorn in my side, one must confess that John Bryce has more courage than the rest of the town combined. He wrote another scathing article about me, I suppose?
Scathing?
Bad.
Yes, sir, he did. But that ain't all he wrote.
Oh? What else did he write about me?
Well, nothing else in the newspaper, but he did write a letter to someone, and Clem Dawson, the fellow that works down at the post office, he copied it down.
Did he now? And where is the copy of the letter Bryce wrote?
I got it. Dawson gave it to me because he thought you might want to see it.
Denby took the letter from Buttram and began to read. As Denby read the letter, doing so silently, Buttram walked over to the liquor cabinet to examine its contents. The cabinet was filled with bottles of various wines, liqueurs, and whiskies. He reached for one of the bottles.
The liquor in this cabinet is not to be touched, sir. That is a reserved cache.
There is some rye whiskey in the cabinet, Mr. Tolliver. You may serve that to Mr. Buttram.
Yes, sir.
Tolliver poured a glass of the rye whiskey, turning his nose up slightly at the aroma. Buttram took the glass. He held the glass out for a second serving. Tolliver poured another drink, then looked over at Denby, who had finished the letter and was now deep in thought.
Is something troubling you, sir?
Mr. Buttram, have you ever heard of Matt Jensen?
No, I ain't.
Have you, Mr. Tolliver?
Only what I have read, and from what I read, he must be quite a magnificent fellow.
I suppose that's all in how you look at it. If he is on your side, he is magnificent. But if he is against you, it could be quite troubling.
And is that likely to be the case, my lord? Is Mr. Jensen likely to be against you?
If the newspaper man has his way, it might be.
I can take care of the newspaper man for you. And this time, there won't be no coming back the way he did after Slater and the others did their little job.
No, that's all right. We'll let him be for a while.
Yeah, whatever you say. You're the boss.
But don't leave just yet.
Pulling a piece of paper from his desk, Denby began to write.
See to it that this telegram is sent, will you?
Yes, sir.
Denby returned to his map and began studying it again, although this time his mind was on something else. He was thinking about the man to whom he had just sent the telegram, Lucas Meacham. Denby had employed Meacham's services once before, and if there was anyone he had ever met or even heard about who was more deadly than Ollie Buttram, it was this man. Meacham had once killed an entire family for Denby, father, mother, four kids, and a grandmother thrown in for good measure. He had a reputation for being deadly accurate with his shooting and absolutely merciless with his killing. And though Denby had never met Matt Jensen, he knew it was going to take someone like Lucas Meacham to make certain that Jensen did not become a problem for him.